You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of October 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. We'll find out why Colombians voted against a peace agreement and why Hungarians barely bothered to vote at all as 2016's list of confounding election results lengthened. My guests Robin Lustig and Sebastian Borger will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including, with all due recognition that we've asked a variation on the same question on several dozen previous occasions, will revelations about Donald Trump's taxes, or the lack thereof, be the straw that finally cracks this somewhat overstaying camel? The UK's Prime Minister sort of names the date upon which the country might begin thinking about contemplating serious discussion of eventually leaving the European Union, but what does the ongoing lack of any hurry tell us? And as best-selling but anonymous Italian author Elena Ferrante is apparently unmasked, we will ask, should a nom de plume be respected? And is hiding behind one a realistic ambition in the online age? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the broadcaster and journalist Robin Lustig, former presenter of the BBC's The World Tonight, and Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung. Welcome both. And we will start with that tale of two referenda, neither of which worked out quite as those who called them planned, anticipated, or desired. In Colombia, if by a wafer-thin margin, voters rejected a peace deal struck after years of negotiation and half a century of war with the rebel group FARC. In Hungary, the government's plan to reject EU migrant quotas was heartily endorsed by voters, but not by that many of them. We'll start with Colombia, and I'll start with you, Robin. I don't know how many times I've sat in this chair and said this year, well, no one saw this coming, but no one saw this coming. The pre-poll polls were about 66% for yes. Why did Colombians vote against a peace deal?
I think there are probably a number of reasons, but my impression from what I've read, and I haven't been in Colombia for 3 or 4 years now, is that a substantial number of Colombians didn't like the blanket amnesty that was being offered to former FARC rebels. FARC, the left-wing rebel group which has created so much mayhem in Colombia for so long, was responsible for some terrible atrocities. So, it has to be said, were right-wing militias as well. But the idea that some of these people, literally with a lot of blood on their hands, should get away scot-free appears to have been just too much for Colombian voters to take. But on your general point, Andrew, the thing about referendums is do not ask the question unless you are absolutely certain what the answer is going to be. It's just not. It's too risky. Also, one other point I would make. It's not compatible with parliamentary democracy. The thing about parliamentary democracy is you elect representatives to make decisions according to their best judgment. And if you're not prepared to let them do that, and you're always going to throw the decision-making back to the people who, on the whole, have not spent every waking hour wondering about the rights and wrongs of any particular issue, then you're undermining what we in the UK call the sovereignty of Parliament, and you get into real trouble.
Sebastian, a lot of people have made comparisons over the last few years between the peace process in Colombia with that of Northern Ireland. The Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland was put to the vote on both sides of the border. It was endorsed by thumping margins in both the Republic and in Northern Ireland, and that was an agreement which did involve quite a lot of people with what you might charitably describe as fairly colourful pasts being allowed into government. People were prepared to accept that in Northern Ireland, clearly not in Colombia. Has the government, or I guess how has Colombia's government underestimated the depth of ill feeling there clearly still is towards FARC?
Can I just say, of course, in Northern Ireland, if you ask people today, I think there is quite a certainly not a majority, but a large part of the population who is quite cross about the way that things were presented back then and have turned out, and particularly the question of amnesties for criminals to all intents and purposes, murderers, killers, political or not. I think that's one of the festering wounds still in Northern Ireland. And Colombia, I mean, Robin at least has been there 4 years ago. I haven't, I must admit. So I don't feel I'm very good at diagnosing this result. But it seems to me quite obvious. You have to, and I disagree with Robin on that. You have to put some important historic decision, a historic compromise like that, to the population. This isn't a parliament. A parliamentary run-of-the-mill decision. This is something which needs the popular approval. I mean, I write for not only for Berliner Zeitung, but for some Swiss regional papers as well. And you know, there, as you know, the Swiss system relies on obviously parliament being there and the government being there. But in the end, they put a lot of stuff to the voters, and it works quite well.
Just a final thought, sorry, Robin, on Colombia before we have to take a look at Hungary as well. Colombian's government before this referendum was very full of there's no plan B. Well, they have to come up with one now, don't they?
They do. I mean, at the moment, and it's early days, both the government and the FARC rebels say they intend to stick to the ceasefire. If they do, well, all well and good. The problem, as we have seen in Northern Ireland and elsewhere, is that it's only too easy for splinter groups to break off and say, well, we don't accept it and we're going to keep going. And it's not that difficult for things to start unravelling. On the general point, though, I was reminded while I was reading about Colombia this morning about something that Tony Blair once said to John Major when he was Prime Minister. He said, the difference between us is that I lead my party, he follows his. And one of the things that politicians are meant to do is lead. And going back a very long time in UK politics, when capital punishment was abolished by a Labour government under Harold Wilson, if that had been put to a referendum at the time, the proposal would have been overwhelmingly defeated.
I think if it was put to a referendum tomorrow, to be honest, you would get a fairly similar result.
No, I don't think so. I think there is evidence that a smallish majority of the UK public now agree that capital punishment is not appropriate.
We should take a quick look at Hungary as well. I'll ask you, Sebastian, because there is something, I guess, especially from a German perspective, faintly hilarious about the Hungarian referendum. This was on EU migration quotas, under which Hungary was being asked to accept 1,294 asylum seekers, a tiny fraction, obviously, of what Germany has taken in some weeks in the last year or so. They got 98% agreeing to Viktor Orban's proposition that they should tell the EU to cram it, but only on a 43% turnout. Viktor Orban is claiming victory anyway. If he does go ahead and write this into Hungary's constitution, how should the EU respond?
Well, first of all, of course, it's to be honest, not terribly hilarious from Berlin's perspective. I think Berlin is really extremely worried and stroke cross with not just the Hungarian government, but a number of governments in Central and Eastern Europe. Hungary, you have to remember, of course, has a very special place in German people's hearts, the way they opened their border in 1989 and started what became the fall of the wall. We look at Hungary aghast. We look at Hungary aghast. A country of that generosity and of great culture and history behaving like this. I mean, we could go into the history of why it is, but I mean, a cynical measure to whip up emotion, totally unnecessary, because of course he can't be forced anyway. I mean, as we have seen over the last year, I mean, people always get upset about the EU doing this or that or the other, and in fact the EU doesn't do anything if national governments don't agree, as we have seen.
Well, moving seamlessly along on the subject of intransigent demagogues, we should take a look at the United States, and it does seem a slightly ridiculous temptation of the fates to wonder if the New York Times revelations about Donald Donald Trump's taxes might be what finally undoes the orange Republican presidential nominee. Trump does, after all, perpetrate several gaffes, blunders or scandals which would be sufficient on their own to derail any normal campaign every day. But he's still somehow in the running. But he spent months brandishing his immense wealth as an indicator of his acumen, as opposed to an indicator of his father's immense wealth. So, Robin, how does he style out the accusation that he has paid no federal taxes for 20 years?
Well, as he said in the debate with Hillary Clinton last week, shows he's smart. Business people try to avoid paying taxes wherever they can. They see it as their responsibility to their shareholders and to their investors not to pay a penny or a cent more than they
have. At which point we should observe that actually Donald, there is no suggestion that he's done anything actually illegal.
No, absolutely not. He declared a loss of nearly $1 billion.
We've all had years like that.
Speak for yourself. But for a man who claims to be one of America's most successful businessmen, I mean, that does take the breath away. Having said that, Andrew, look, I have not been able to understand from the very beginning how Donald Trump has managed to make as much headway as he has. It looks as if he was right when he said many months ago that if he went out and stood in Fifth Avenue and shot someone dead, he'd still get elected.
I have made this observation many times. You do have to get to the point of starting to assemble bizarre theoretical hypothetical conjectures about what he could actually do that would put off a plurality of his supporters. I mean, Sebastian, is it likely, as I fear it actually is, that a lot of people will react to this by thinking, as we would say in the old country, well, good on him?
Yes, we have a similar saying in Bavarian, a Hund ist a Show, which doesn't translate. He's a dog, it doesn't translate. In other words, he's done something dodgy or even slightly illegal, but he got away with it. The fascinating thing about it is it feeds into sentiment which is found in many countries, that people are totally fed up with crony capitalism. I mean, I've just been to the, which we may talk about later, the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham, as I was last week at the Labour Party conference. And of course, a lot of the talk is about why people voted for Brexit. Well, that is part of it, that people feel the elite gets away with it. Companies, CEOs with their telephone number salaries.
Like Donald Trump.
Exactly, but also companies like Apple and Google and Trump Incorporated, apparently, not paying any tax or ridiculously small sums.
Donald Trump seems to epitomize the absolute polar extreme from conventional politics. Normally, politicians try to persuade voters that they do everything right, that they are good people.
They do it by the book,
they do
exactly.
It by the book, yeah.
That's why everybody else has published their tax returns who's run for president for the last 40 years.
Trump says, I'm not like that. I'm like you. I try to get away with as much as I can. I duck and I weave and I look for the advantage. I'm just an ordinary guy, but I've just got a lot more money.
But I'll put this to you, Sebastian, is it one of those things where what seems striking about this is it merely a question of scale rather than morality? Because I think most people, and I think I speak on behalf of most self-employed journalists here, you know, there are deductions available, so you take them. Most people make whatever efforts are available to them to pay as little tax as they actually can. For most of us, that doesn't run into the billions of dollars. But is it just a question of scale?
Are journalists supposed to go to an art museum when they don't actually write about that particular exhibition and show their press pass and get in for free?
It's an outrageous calumny upon our profession, to suggest that anybody would ever do such
a
thing.
It's all over the place. And I know it's different in scale. I'm the treasurer of a small musical charity. I'm being approached by some musicians who say to me, well, if you give us the money in cash, the fee will be smaller. What do I do? You know, we have those kind of questions all the time. And to be fair, a lot of people will close one or indeed two eyes and do things which they shouldn't. But I do think it's a very worrying development if still the most powerful country on earth is willing to put someone who openly admits to that kind of behavior into the most powerful office. I mean, we've come a long way.
Robin, if it isn't going to be the tax thing that sinks him, and it doesn't strike me that it's going to, what have you made of other recent developments which do seem to have had some effect on his poll numbers, for all that polls now appear to be worth to us? This is in the last few days. He's sort of been up in the middle of the night berating a former Miss Universe in the early hours, you know, on Twitter. There's now been a sort of chorus of accusations of sexism from his former colleagues on The Apprentice.
He's going out of his way to alienate huge numbers of voters. I mean, what he has said about women, specific women and women in general, makes it very difficult for a lot of women even to consider voting for him. What he has said about ethnic minorities has made it virtually impossible for ethnic minorities to vote for him. What he has said about paying taxes makes it very difficult for taxpayers to vote for him. I think there are things that are really going to damage him. But most of all, I think the fact that he is unpredictable, the fact that he appears not to have taken the first of his debates seriously and bombed catastrophically in the first of the three debates he's going to be taking part in, must raise questions in voters' minds as whether this is the kind of guy who is actually the sort of man you want to be sitting in the Oval Office in the White House taking really tricky decisions.
Well, isn't our worry, as it was in the Brexit campaign, that the other side is just very weak? That you know, Hillary Clinton isn't a convincing candidate?
Democrat friends of mine in America say Hillary Clinton is the only Democrat candidate who could lose to Donald Trump.
No, I think one of the most extraordinary stories about this campaign, which will doubtless fill riveting books when it's all over, is that the anguish that must be going on in both parties, because the Republicans must be thinking any sane Republican candidate would beat Hillary Clinton, and the Democrats must be thinking any candidate but Hillary Clinton would win 40 states against Donald Trump.
It's a weird political system, isn't it, when both parties end up with candidates they wish they hadn't got.
But as I have also thought, it's the one thing you can kind of claim as a reassurance during this entire year, is that it surely has to serve as the final rebuke to people who insist that the world is secretly controlled from the smoke-filled room by genius puppet masters these guys, if they're secretly controlling the world, that they are asleep at the switch this year. On that hopefully reassuring note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House. Coming up next, the interminable Brexit saga continues.
The well-turned-out, style-themed October issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. We tour the globe for the best in the world of retail, with a ranking of the companies and developers doing it best from Sydney to Seoul, past Porto and Poznan. Here's what our sharp-eyed editors have spotted for you this month.
In the design section, we set sail to Copenhagen to see the striking modernist headquarters of shipping giant Maersk.
In the edits pages, we make reservations at a late-night restaurant started by the talented souls behind Apartamento magazine in Barcelona.
Monocle's October issue is on newsstands now, or guarantee your copy by joining as a Monocle subscriber. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me, Robin Lustig and Sebastian Borger. We will look now at the UK, where Prime Minister Theresa May has declared her intention to initiate the country's departure from the EU in March, as demanded by voters back in June. She will trigger Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, which formally launches two agonising, tedious, expensive, energy-sapping years of bickering, squabbling, recrimination and chaos before delivering the country to a position which at best will be no better than the one it already had. Sebastian, markets, as you will have noticed, have responded to this announcement by treating the pound like it had caught fire. Is that a sign of things to come?
Andrew, you sound slightly biased. we should, as the Prime Minister says now, stand together and ensure that Brexit is a success for the country.
And don't good luck with that.
Robin, do we still think she's actually going to do this, or has she just bought herself another 6 months in which to think of a reason not to?
Oh, no, I think she's going to do it.
She has
I think
to.
She absolutely has to. Also, I think there is quite a lot of reason now to believe that although on the surface she claimed to have been in favour of the UK remaining in the EU, I don't think she really was very bothered either way. And everything she has said since the referendum vote seems to indicate that she's bought into the Leave project wholeheartedly. She's going to do it, but it's going to take a very long time. 2 years is only the beginning of it. Because if Britain is not going to remain a member of the European single market, there are going to be dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of trade deals that are going to have to be negotiated one by one, sector by sector, agonising paragraph by agonising paragraph. It's going to take, I would guess, at least a decade.
It's going to be terrific fun.
Guys, isn't it? Oh, it's going to be great.
Can I make a serious point here? We around this table may all have either voted for Remain or obviously been in favour of it. The point is the country took this decision and it is the sovereign will of the British people. Now, everybody, I'm sounding pompous, I know, but it needs to be. I think that the Remainers now buy into it and seriously try and bring their expertise to the table to make it a success.
I agree with you entirely.
We can't keep on going on saying, oh, well, these people were all stupid or ill-informed or lied to, which they may have been. I don't disagree. But the problem is we've got to move forward. And you've got to also, of course, see the other side. I mean, the continent has to have some, after mourning for Britain and Germany is still mourning.
Even Philip Hammond, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, said, I think this morning, that it's going to be rocky. There are going to be trouble. I mean, there is nothing wrong, surely, with commentators and others saying, look, yeah, we're going to do it, but it's not going to be easy. It's going to take a long time. There's going to be difficulties along the way. The British economy is going to take a hit, at least in the short term. All of those things may be true, even while one accepts, as I certainly do, what you say, the referendum wasn't expression of the popular will. It is what people want to happen. Britain should now leave the EU. That vote have taken place. But that doesn't mean we all have to say yuppie-doo-doo, it's going to be wonderful.
No, and you're quite right. That's what I thought Theresa May, that was lacking from her speech. I would have said, look, I'm your captain and we're setting sail very soon. But be aware that the weather forecast is looking slightly gloomy and there'll be the odd storm ahead. And she didn't do that. She talked about the now Britain becoming a fully independent and sovereign nation again, where I think, come on.
Sebastian, you were at the Conservative, you've been at the Conservative conference in Birmingham,
yes.
Is that right? I mean, I think it has been forgotten, given the attention that has been paid in this country to the hugely entertaining internal wrangles of the opposition Labour Party. It has therefore been forgotten that the Conservative Party is not historically a generally happy camp, and indeed for decades, the primary schism in the Tory party has been Europe. Does it strike you now at a party unified and completely at ease with itself?
No. And Robin, in a way, of course, that's true. What Robin says, you know, there are people, and why not? You know, they've got a very clear opinion that Britain should have remained a member of the EU, and they will warn and advise, for example, the whole question of whether or not Parliament should be involved in the decision on Article 50, I think is a valid question and can there are very interesting constitutional issues involved. So no, that's and the Conservative Party is going to be as divided as ever.
And what one has to remember as well, Andrew, Theresa May's government has a 12-seat majority in the House of Commons. She is not a kind of party leader who has an enormous coterie of friends and allies she can count on. She's a loner. She has not been elected with the wholehearted approval of all her MPs.
And she hasn't got a popular mandate.
Absolutely not. She fell into the job because nobody else was around. They fell by the wayside at the first hurdle.
She was the only adult.
She was the only adult in the room. Yeah, exactly. It's not going to be long before she runs into serious trouble with her own party. It's going to be bloody.
Okay. Well, that's something to look forward to. And finally tonight, we should look at the curious case of Elena Ferrante and ask the question of why we want to know stuff about people who create work we like and how much of it we have a right to know. These questions have been thrown into sharp relief by the apparent exposure of the true identity of the umpty-selling Italian author. Italian journalist Claudio Gatti has outed her as a translator called Anita Raja. Sebastian, first of all, do Elena Ferrante's readers have a right to know this?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I tend to agree, but there
I'm appalled by this whole thing. I mean, we've had the same thing a few years ago with the famous British-English graffiti artist Banksy, who was outed. He wants to remain. We now know he's from Bristol, and I've already forgotten the name. Doesn't particularly matter to me. He does great art. What's the problem? Why can't he remain anonymous?
I think anybody who admires a work of art, whether it's a series of books, and I have read Elena Ferrante's novels and I love them hugely, whether it's a painting, whether it's a work, a piece of music, you are bound to ask yourself, who created this? What kind of a person were they? What were the influences? What led to this thing which I love so much being
created? But you don't
created?
Have a right to know.
That's interesting. Who has a right to do what? Journalists are in the business of disclosing things that someone somewhere doesn't want to have disclosed. I'm not sure that an artist has an automatic right to have their wish for privacy to be respected.
Is that the difference, though, between a right and an expectation?
Well, maybe. And also, you could argue that journalists have a responsibility to respect the wishes of an artist. Up to a point, Lord Copper, as Evelyn Waugh might have said, she has made a huge amount of money. She has, if this account that has been published is true, bought some extremely luxurious apartments with the money that has been made. She has benefited hugely and quite rightly from the success of her work. It could be argued that the price that you pay as a successful artist is to allow people to know a bit about you, to ask who you are. She has given interviews.
Isn't this getting a little bit into the Homer Simpson quote, isn't it, about saying if they didn't want people going through their bins and saying they're gay, they shouldn't have tried to express themselves creatively?
No, it is saying that if, as an author, you give interviews anonymously, by email only, obviously, and you drop hints about who you are, then you are tempting people. If she'd really, really, really wanted to stay out of the public eye, she should have said nothing.
I think Robin is making a great case, but he does sound like a British tabloid journalist trying to justify publishing salacious details.
Well, yeah, because to follow
celebrity.
That up, Robin, and I'm sure it falls to every journalist at some point. You must have learned something or heard something about somebody famous or someone well known that they may not have wanted known, and thought, you know what, that's actually none of my business.
Somebody once phoned me when I was a news editor on a national paper and said, "Are you interested in the private life of a very prominent politician?" I said, "Only if it impinges directly on his public duties." And the person on the other end of the phone said, "What a pity," and put the phone down. As far as I know, I missed a story. But I don't feel bad about it. I probably meant I wasn't a very good news editor. Of course there are stories that shouldn't be published and which aren't anybody's right to know. I don't think we're damaging the real Elena Ferrante, if indeed it is who it is now claimed to be. We're simply saying we have a right to know something that you don't want us to know. Sorry.
Well, final, a similar question to you before we go, Sebastian. Had you had the hot tip on the real identity of Elena Ferrante, would you have published?
That's not fair.
Yes, it is. That's exactly the right question.
Look, I was a crime reporter. I've had all sorts of information about all sorts of people in Munich. And we had to take decisions, I'm not exaggerating, on a weekly basis. And I do think in this case, I don't see it. Obviously, I want to know. Obviously, I can enjoy a piece of music by J.S. Bach maybe more deeply, knowing that he lost, I don't know, half of his children in infancy. He expresses emotions in that way, but not a living author.
We will have to leave it there, unfortunately. Sebastian Borger and Robin Lustig, thank you for joining us. That is all for this edition of Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maria Khan. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's music next, 1900 Rob Bound with The Culture Show, and I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at 1800 London time tomorrow, but for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.